You know, I think data poisoning from an AI perspective or LLM poisoning is really something that folks have talked about in theory for a long time. Like, oh, well, technically, if you train something on the wrong data, it can give you what might be the wrong or malicious answer and response. And instead, we're seeing like, oh, yeah, it's very possible. And they actually made it work.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, Weekly Intel Chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. How you doing, Matt Bromley?
Hey, Chris. I'm doing well, sir. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Far along in Spooktober, starting to talk to my kids about what we're going to do for Halloween and thinking about hitting the pumpkin patch this weekend to get some jack-o'-lanterns going.
There you go. Well, you got to get a pumpkin to then make a jack-o'-lantern, right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, there you got to get one to make the other. So totally understand. But it is almost Halloween. You're right.
My son has a great idea this year. He wants to make a fountain out of one of the pumpkins. So I think I'm just gonna
put a hole
in the top and get a fish pump and see if we can make something happen there.
That's actually going to be pretty cool. Yeah. I've seen sometimes some folks will turn them into all sorts of like fish bowls and stuff like that. You'll see like they'll actually put a fish bowl inside. And then kind of, I think, seal it back around the back and then have a fish kind of swimming around throughout the pumpkin and stuff. It's kind of cool to see. But I find that with most jack-o'-lanterns, it's like a one-sided building, right? If you see the beautiful front facade, you're like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And then you go around the back and you see everything it took to make the front look as good as it did. And jack-o'-lanterns fall into those same category for me. But it is almost Halloween. You're right.
Yeah. I love this time of year, so it's fun to see it through the eyes of my kids. You know, they get really excited around it. So,
absolutely. That's awesome, man. Great to hear. Good. Best of luck. My kids don't have their costumes picked out just yet, so I don't have an update on that. I was actually going to comment and say I can remember, I think, back when we were talking about it being the first of the year, and here we are midway through October as it is. And wow, time flies when you're having fun or you're trying to keep track of all the bad stuff going on in cybersecurity.
I notice you're in another location that's different than normal.
I am, yeah, as usual. It's where in the world is Matt this week as we're recording. I'm actually coming to you live right now. Those of you watching, you'll be hearing the recorded version. I'm coming to Chris live, as it were, straight from Madrid, Spain.
Nice.
So I'm out here with the family having fun, enjoying a little trip. And I will be in a different place actually for the next couple of weeks. I'll make sure to mention on them all.
Okay, great. Let's dive into it. So CrowdStrike is tracking a mass exploitation campaign leveraging a previously unknown vulnerability in Oracle E-Business Suite, or EBS, now identified as CVE-2025-61882. The flaw enables unauthenticated remote code execution and has reportedly been exploited in the wild as early as August 9th, 2025. While CrowdStrike has assessed with moderate confidence that Graceful Spider is behind the campaign, there is still a possibility that other actors may also be involved, particularly due to the release of a public proof-of-concept exploit on October 3, 2025. Oracle disclosed the vulnerability and released a patch on October 4th, including indicators of compromise that corroborate the exploit has been used in real attacks. The exploitation chain begins with an authentication bypass targeting the sync servlet endpoint, sometimes enabling access via elevated admin privileges. Attackers then utilize Oracle's XML Publisher Template Manager to upload and execute a malicious XSLT template using GET and POST requests to specific endpoints. Successful execution triggers outbound connections from the compromised Java server process to attacker-controlled infrastructure over port 443. These connections are typically used to deploy web shells and establish persistence within the victim environment. In some cases, the adversary employed a multi-file payload, setting up memory resident backdoors invoked through specific filter chains. So sounds like something pretty serious going on with CrowdStrike.
Sounds like a fun time if you're an Oracle e-business suite user, I guess. CrowdStrike over here tracking this as Graceful Spider. I'm going to do my best. Those of you watching who might know more than me, please don't hold this one against me. I believe Spider is CrowdStrike's nomenclature for any threat actor who is financially motivated. So not necessarily country specific. But in this case, it would indicate that some sort of a cybercrime or, you know, again, financially motivated threat actor would be the ones behind this. I think that aligns a little bit with what we see some of the techniques kind of leading to web shell deployment. There's some email addresses that have been associated with CLOP, the CLOP branded email victims would then, of course, indicate, okay, this is definitely ransomware related, right? Whether they're an affiliate or kind of initial access or something like that. But that being said, you know, interesting vulnerability for sure. Gives folks, I think, a really, you know, tough thing to think about here. And I'm kind of reading through some of the details of how this can be used. The goal here is, as you mentioned, Chris, right, an authentication bypass that allows ultimately code execution. One of the most common uses of this for adversaries is to deploy some sort of a web shell or some sort of a thing on the remote system. And then, you know, use that to, you know, execute further commands or do additional stuff or whatever it might be. So with that said, you know, something to look into. One other thing that I think I found pretty interesting as part of this was the whole idea of it wasn't announced as being seen in the wild, but it was announced with, you know, IOCs like IP addresses and observed commands and files. So I'm not sure, Chris, if they kind of skipped over that whole in the wild part or just made an assumption of like, hey, we're publishing this stuff, therefore it's there. Like, assume it's in the wild unless we say otherwise, maybe. Not entirely sure about that one, but nonetheless, an interesting vulnerability.
Maybe those people didn't want to be outed.
Yeah, that's also possible too, right? Maybe there's some secret thing out there somewhere or whatever. Not sure. Yeah. With that said, really interesting campaign. Something if you are an Oracle e-business suite user, I definitely recommend, you know, getting into this one. CrowdStrike does give some of their own product specific search queries and whatnot that can be used to look through this throughout their logs, both in LogScale and Falcon NGSIM. But regardless, anyone out there, if you're a user of this technology, this software, you know what I'm going to say. Chris is going to say it too. Patch, patch, patch. Never changes.
All right, so Graceful Spider appears to have emailed multiple organizations on September 29th, 2025, claiming responsibility for data theft via Oracle EBS. These emails reference known Graceful Spider infrastructure and use their CLOP branding, adding weight to the attribution, though only with moderate confidence. Meanwhile, a Telegram post insinuating involvement from other groups, including Scattered Spider, Slippy Spider, and Shiny Hunters, introduced a potentially separate actor into the mix. The Telegram user criticized Graceful Spider and shared a SHA-256 hash of an exploit matching known IOCs, raising the possibility that multiple groups may be leveraging the same or similar exploits independently. The risk of widespread exploitation is increasing due to the release of the POC in patch. CrowdStrike expects threat actors with Oracle EBS familiarity to weaponize the exploit rapidly. Given the complexity of Oracle environments, CrowdStrike's recommendations include immediate patching, reviewing outbound connections from Oracle EBS to external IPs, and searching the templates database table for malicious template code. Additionally, organizations should investigate any suspicious sessions involving the sysadmin or guest accounts and consider temporarily isolating EBS services from internet exposure. Falcon, LogScale, and SIM rule templates have also been made available to CrowdStrike customers to help detect exploitation indicators, particularly Java-based command execution and outbound communications over port 443. While the root cause analysis is ongoing, the current campaign demonstrates a high level of sophistication, including multi-stage payloads and post-exploitation persistence techniques. Given the criticality of Oracle EBS and enterprise environments, organizations should assume that public disclosure of this vulnerability will lead to opportunistic attacks and adjust detection and response efforts accordingly. So that last line I find interesting that they made a point of mentioning that, because I think as, you know, AI becomes more and more prevalent within the threat actor community, if you want to call it that, we're going to see this stuff being actioned faster and faster. Like, I think there's just going to be, you know, almost like spawn camping on the CBS or CVE reports, and then the AI will be able to roll these things out faster than humans can patch and get ready for them.
Chris, I would not put that past any threat actor out there whatsoever, even opportunistic or lower level threat actors. They're gonna utilize AI. And I mean, there's an odd twist here, which is I've actually seen someone do this before. Now, it was a curated presentation, so it was intentionally designed this way. But someone essentially uploaded, or I should say copy-pasted in, a vulnerable script into an LLM and essentially asked, you know, the AI at the time, what's wrong with this script? And that type of like high-level overall question usually doesn't register very well, because what's wrong is like, well, you wrote this piece of code, it's doing what it's supposed to do. However, the LLM came back with, oh, you're not sanitizing your inputs, right? And there was no determination anywhere of just kind of like what was wrong with that. It was just kind of pulling on like, all right, well, I have an abundance of training data or an abundance of external resources that tell me I should be sanitizing inputs, and that's a vulnerability, and that this is what's wrong with your thing, right? And in that situation, and again, curated response, but in that situation, it was very much geared towards, okay, I wrote a piece of code with an intentional vulnerability, right? You can start to engineer your prompts differently and start to get very different results out of this, right? Like if I crafted this type of payload, what would get returned? If I did this, if I did that. One fun little example that I actually had to recently walk through, Chris, is I was setting up it was for a kind of a sandbox testing environment, but I was setting up a domain forward for a sim. And I essentially went to an LLM and I said, hey, I need to forward this thing. Can you write me the Nginx config that does this thing, right? And it wrote a basic Nginx config that did a thing. And I came back and I said, okay, these four URLs don't work. These 10 do. So I had a basis of testing. And I said, based on these four, here's the error codes that I'm getting back. And I was able to train it. And it was able to say, oh, okay, based on the four, you're likely, you know, dealing with this. So we'll insert some redirects. We'll do this. We'll do that. It configured, you know, Nginx correctly for me. Chris, it added in two more that I hadn't thought of. And what it had done after I kind of looked at it later was it had kind of done some extra, because I did an internet enabled search. It kind of did some external things and was like, hey, every time someone mentions this thing in Stack Overflow or help articles, these other URLs get mentioned yet. And even though the user didn't talk about them, there's a chance that he might see this in the future. So we're going to go ahead and throw in a redirect for these two. And that type of thing where it's building and learning and growing, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, what type of errors can I expect with this? And if someone's like, oh, well, if you do this, you'll get that. And that's unexpected. We should patch that. It's kind of like, whoa, don't patch. Write me a script that crafts a payload that takes advantage of that. We just crossed the line between using AI for good versus using AI for bad. And that like simple little process of going through, debugging, asking for code review, getting feedback, adjusting, you know, all that tweaking is how folks are vibe coding these days, right? They're just, the end product ends up being legitimate. But if I swoop in with a bunch of code that I think is likely vulnerable, or there's been a vulnerability announcement and I have an older version of the repository, I might jump in and I might say, hey, let's analyze this. Help me find an error or something that's wrong here. And next thing you know, someone's weaponized what was a previously unweaponized but known exploit or vulnerability, I should say, and is now a piece of public exploit that's out there. And I didn't need to spin up a server. I didn't need to test anything. The LLM that I'm talking with was able to lean on its knowledge of web requests, history, and vulnerability and just simply say, ah, it's likely this. And boom, there we go. Completely almost autonomous. Like kind of web vulnerability or maybe web-facing vulnerability detection or analysis or finding, if you will. I'm not, what's the word we're looking for here? I don't want to say spawning because it already existed, but discovery maybe, right?
Yeah.
Can just be done simply just by just like scanning a code and saying, find me the errors. And it can be that easy sometimes.
It's interesting. I think the last article we're going to talk about is sort of about poisoning LLM models with very tiny amount of poison data. And I feel like
there's some
spots to inject some malicious stuff in there. But
all right, I'll one put thing a at pin a time. In that. We'll come back to it.
Yeah. All right. So next up, a threat group tracked as Storm2603 has been observed using the open source Velociraptor Defer tool as part of its post-exploitation toolkit in recent ransomware attacks. Velociraptor, originally developed by Michael Cohen and later acquired by Rapid7 in 2021, is a legitimate security tool meant for endpoint visibility and incident response. However, researchers at Cisco Talos recently discovered the group deployed Velociraptor during an attack in August to maintain persistent access to victim systems while deploying multiple ransomware families, namely Warlock, Lockbit, and Babook, on VMware ESXi infrastructure. This marks a notable evolution in attacker tactics. While Velociraptor has been widely used by defenders, this is the first confirmed case of it being operationalized during a live ransomware attack. The attackers installed version 0.73.4.0 of the tool, which is known to be vulnerable to CVE-2025-6264, a privilege escalation flaw. That vulnerability enabled the attackers to escalate their privilege and execute arbitrary commands, turning what is normally a defensive tool into a post-exploitation backdoor with wide reach across endpoints. So I found this fascinating because they basically weaponized a particular version because of a known privilege escalation flaw. So they didn't alter the code. They just made sure that they installed a version that they knew had this vulnerability.
Yeah, Chris, this one hits very, very close to home. Full disclosure for everyone. Lima Charlie, where Chris is at, supports usage of Velociraptor and has had a long-running integration with it. And then some kind of, I would say, common friends of ours, Eric Capuano and Whitney Champion, are also, very big Velociraptor trainers. I think, Chris, we've had Velociraptor in our sights, in our schedule, in our discussions for years now. Mm-hmm. And I know awesome one of tool. The... It's a fantastic default tool for endpoint triage, collection, and incident response. And I do remember Eric mentioning at some point, he's like, this is going to happen. Like, it's an extremely powerful tool out there with crazy kernel level capabilities from a default perspective. It's just a matter of time before someone weaponizes this thing. And unfortunately, we've seen it happen, you know? And just so everyone is clear, this isn't unique to Velociraptor, right? Sys internals tools have continued to be abused again and again and again by adversaries. So adversaries, and Chris, I'm going to say this with the right amount of passion, adversaries getting lazy and repurposing blue team tools is just like the worst type of icing on the cake, because it proves that our tools are fantastic and they work and they do a good job. But it means that the adversaries are like, oh, this thing is, I'll use this. It's going to be much better for me. And unfortunately, that's what we saw in this case. The use of Velociraptor as a like C2 agent, for lack of a better term. And that's the important takeaway for everyone here. It's not that the adversaries were necessarily doing forensic work, if you will. I believe they first utilized it as a C2 agent that they installed. I'm looking for it here. Threat actor used the tool to download and execute Visual Studio code with the intention of creating a tunnel. So what the adversaries have kind of been seen using this for is kind of like an initial stage downloader slash dropper. That's one of the really strong capabilities from a Velociraptor perspective, is you can kind of auto magically script and configure it to, you know, download and install certain scripts and files and whatnot. And I think adversaries are probably taking advantage of that, you know, particular feature set, if you will. But then also, Chris, they switched C2s at some point as well. And I'm looking at this one mentioned here where I believe the adversary ultimately switched to another system, using Cloudflare's workers.dev service and whatnot. So there's a little bit of a overlap in time here. I believe this is the second time this has been happening, the first time for Storm-2603. But interestingly enough, it's unfortunately, I'm not going to say a trend yet, but this is the second time in as many months as we've talked about it. And definitely gives us reason to say, hey, you know, adversaries are misusing this and it's become a little too frequent now.
Yeah. So Cisco Talos believes this kind of abuse reflects a growing trend in adversary tradecraft, namely the repurposing of legitimate open source and commercial tools for lateral movement, persistence, and command execution. This trend aligns with findings in Talos's 2024 year in review report. While Velociraptor includes features designed to make a malicious use detectable, such as deliberate generation of indicators of compromise, attackers can compile custom versions that suppress these indicators. Such binaries will typically lack official Rapid7 signatures or will be signed by third parties, offering defenders at least one detection vector. Rapid7, for its part, confirmed that it is not impacted by these incidents and has added detection logic for Velociraptor misuse. It recommends security teams validate all Velociraptor deployments in their environments, scan for unexpected services, or schedule tasks involving Velociraptor.exe and block any unsigned or unknown instances. The key takeaway is that defenders now need to treat even their own security tooling as potential vectors of compromise, especially when those tools are freely available to adversaries. Man, and it does seem like we've seen a bunch of this year, right, Matt? I am trying to think of some of the other tools that have come up.
I believe one thing that is kind of sticking with me is I believe we also reviewed together multiple, I think, like kind of EDR agent, not bypasses, but kind of like sidecars or you know, side caddies or kind of ride-alongs.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, I think we saw some abuse of that. We're seeing Velociraptor in there. And Chris, what this is telling me is that adversaries, I think EDR is actually putting up a pretty good fight for a lot of adversaries, and what they're doing is looking for ways to subvert it, and they're having to lean on like known good free and open source software and binaries that might be signed, or they're looking for resources they can lean on and say, hopefully this thing has been on an allow list somewhere, and that will let me get in. But as I mentioned, you know, in this situation, at least as far as I can tell and based on what I read, I don't think they installed Velociraptor and used it as a defer tool just with malicious intent. I think it was just an initial stager, in which case they're likely, they're leaning on the reputation of the binary, and they're using that to kind of as a bypass to get through, ultimately trying to switch over to some other malicious program that they might have more comfort with. But as much as I hate to say it, Chris, we might get to a point where we see Velociraptor being used just full on forensically. From an adversarial perspective, you know, dumping passwords, you know, browser history, all that kind of stuff, and saying, hey, you know, I got a defer system installed here. I'm going to treat it like that, pull a bunch of data back, do analysis, and boom, I've got everything I need on this victim. And that's not the best place to be in. So anything we can do to shore these up, I think there's some quick wins here for folks. If you don't use Velociraptor in your environment, if you have no idea what Chris and I are talking about, you know, put these binaries on a watch list. Yeah, put these binaries on a watch list. Put this in a situation where you have an eye out, and you know the adversary doesn't slip by you with a legitimate tool here.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the success of EDR too. I think there's a lot of support behind the idea that that's what's driving threat actors into these edge devices too, because EDR doesn't have a presence there, so it's a little easier to slip under the radar and get persistence.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right, next up, I know you're going to love this one. North Korean IT workers operating under state direction continue to infiltrate international tech companies using false identities and anonymizing infrastructure to secure jobs and route payments in cryptocurrency. These workers are often deployed via sanctioned entities like Chiangyang Information Technology Corporation Company, and they earn salaries that are ultimately funneled to the DPRK regime to support weapons of mass destruction and missile development programs. Regulators like OFAC or OFAC and South Korea's Ministry of Foreign Affairs have increasingly targeted these operations, including naming individual facilitators and their associated crypto wallets. For instance, Russian and Chinese nationals such as Sim Hyun Sop and Lu Hyung have been sanctioned for helping launder millions in virtual assets tied to these schemes. Chainalysis tracks the associated addresses and laundering methods used, which increasingly involve stablecoins and complex blockchain maneuvers. Payments to DPRK IT workers are typically structured to resemble regular salaries, around 5,000 monthly in many cases, paid in stablecoins to minimize volatility and to interface more easily with over-the-counter or OTC traders. These traders, often operating in low regulation environments, serve as the final conduit to convert crypto into fiat currency. Evidence from the DOJ forfeiture actions show how these funds are later consolidated, obscured via layering techniques, and rerouted to North Korean actors through both regulated and unregulated exchanges. So, I mean, there's a lot here, but I'm just going to say, if you're hiring somebody and they request to be paid in cryptocurrency, you might want to take a closer look.
Yeah, maybe possibly. I mean, you know, Chris, actually, I read through this article and I wanted to take a little bit of a different take on it. I know for anyone who's listened to Chris and I before, especially when we've come up on this particular topic here, I always have this humorous jest of just this crazy idea of someone training to be an adversarial, you know, offensive computer IT operator, and they get told to go take a coding job and forward their salary back to the dear leader. That's always one that's I find just very interesting. Perhaps maybe a different take on this one. One of the biggest things I got from this article, which I'm actually beginning to really start to look at, Chris, is just how skilled the adversary, the North Korean-based adversaries are in manipulating and taking advantage of cryptocurrency and blockchains and coins and everything like that. You know, every time we talk about these adversaries doing this type of stuff, we always kind of take this route of like, oh yeah, Bitcoin theft, of course, you know, it's going back there. And I think they've kind of cemented, especially from a financial loss or an aggregate perspective, they've cemented their status as the cryptocurrency thieves. But perhaps more interesting is look at how skilled they are in laundering, if you will, this cryptocurrency. I mean, you know, looking at some of the articles, some of the bits of the article that are called out here, there's all sorts of different obfuscation that takes place in flows of funds. I see mentions of like different various platforms and bridge protocols, hopping between different types of coins, intermediary wallets. I mean, it's crazy. Just at how skilled they are in getting that money to a cash out point where they can actually make use of it. And I'm assuming that makes life tougher for law enforcement agencies around the globe. But the other side of it too, and I don't have an answer or a technological fix for this, but like, okay, OFAC's in place and OFAC's like, that's a sanctioned nation. And it's like, okay, we'll just use Bitcoin. And at that point, it's, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with cryptocurrency, but it definitely leans on like, wow, this is a way to subvert any and all global concern that might be out there because this nation is very successful in doing this. So, you know, I would encourage if anyone's curious about this, I mean, I think Chris mentioned the best remediation advice that's out there. If you have someone who refuses to turn their camera on and just something just doesn't feel right, and then they ask you to pay them in cryptocurrency, don't keep that person on staff unless you physically know who they are. And, you know, they're just looking to, you know, trade a few paychecks for Bitcoin. But there's a lot of, you know, red flags in here that I think folks should be looking out for and then use that to help defend and guide your organization if you are worried about having this happen. And if this is something that you're, you know, kind of very concerned about, and maybe you're suspecting you've got some of these employees in your organization and whatnot, then go through and double check by all means, because unfortunately you might be in a spot where you're funding a government that we don't want to be funding.
So laundering operations often leverage decentralized exchanges, bridges, and chain hopping to complicate fund tracing. On-chain analysis reveals that funds are moved between protocols and mixed with other assets, increasing anonymity before being consolidated into wallets controlled by operatives like Sim Lu or North Korean national Kim Sang-man. Sim, for example, used false Russian IDs to open exchange accounts, while Lu used his real identity and UAE residency to gain access to platforms like the now defunct FTX. The use of unhosted wallets and falsified KYC credentials helps the regime bypass compliance checks and sanction barriers, enabling state-directed access to the global crypto infrastructure. After laundering is complete, DPRK operatives off-ramp the funds via OTC brokers or mainstream exchanges using front companies and fake accounts. The final conversions to fiat are difficult to track due to the integration of legitimate-looking payment flows. Advisory warnings from bodies like the FBI and UK's OFSI emphasize behavioral and technical red flags, inconsistent metadata and applications, reluctance to appear on video, stablecoin salary preferences, or underpriced technical work. These indicators, if properly embedded in hiring and compliance processes, can help prevent unintentional participation in North Korea's crypto-driven sanction evasion network. Law enforcement regulators and the private sector all have distinct roles in monitoring and disrupting this revenue stream. So, yeah, it's fascinating. And hats off to the folks at Chainalysis for, you know, building technology to help track this stuff. I've said it before, I'm not a fan of cryptocurrency. I think we'd have a lot less problems in the digital world if cryptocurrency wasn't a thing. You know, I know there's a lot of advocates for all the wonderfulness that it's going to do for us, but you know, most of what I see is just enabling bad people to do bad things.
Yeah, similar boat, unfortunately. And that doesn't mean it is 100% bad. I'm sure there is some good use for it out there. But it is, you know, definitely a primary focus and a vehicle for sanctioned nations to get money out and do stuff with. And it's not always the doesn't always get the best reputation unfortunately. So, you know, there's not really much to do here. We can't, you know, we're not going to ban cryptocurrency. We're not going to shut that world down whatsoever. Yeah. Nor should we, right? And that's not necessarily the remediative advice here. It's just, you know, every organization that's out there, just do your best to try and stop these folks. I mean, one of the things that I've always lived by is that if an adversary does a thing, continues to do a thing, and we hear about it again in the news and again in the news and again and again, it's clearly working. Because if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it anymore, you know? And I don't think they're doing it for, you know, a couple million bucks a month or something like that. They're doing it to the point where it's making an economic impact for them, which tells me it's likely widespread. So with that, you know, let's make sure that we are implementing best hiring mechanisms and watching out for these folks, because they're out there. And I mean, they'll take any job they can. And the other side of it too, Chris, is also who are you hiring and what are they doing with the data they have access to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much ransomware do you think we'd see if you had to go drop a bag of cash off behind a dumpster somewhere to pay the threat actors?
Not very much. Right. And that's the other side of it, too, is this isn't just North Koreans. Right. It's another entire industry that's built on top of this stuff. And what about the coin miner industry, Chris? Yeah. I mean, what would all those folks developing those advanced zero days do if they didn't have a coin miner to install afterwards?
Yeah. Interesting world. Okay, last one up. It's the model poisoning I was talking about. So researchers from Anthropic, the UK AI Security Institute, and the Alan Turing Institute have released the largest study to date on poisoning attacks during pre-training of large language models, or LLMs. The central finding is that injecting as few as 250 malicious documents into the training data is sufficient to create a functional backdoor, regardless of the model size or total volume of training data. This contradicts a long-held assumption that attackers need to control a percentage of the training data to succeed. Instead, the study shows that the absolute count is the more relevant factor. Models with parameters ranging from 600 million to 13 billion, trained on proportionally scaled data, were all vulnerable to the same fixed number of poisoned examples. The researchers targeted a narrow kind of backdoor behavior, generating gibberish text when prompted with a specific trigger phrase, which in this case is just like a XML pseudo. This was chosen because the success of the attack could be measured reliably without additional fine-tuning and because it posed relatively low real-world risk. Still, the consistency of attack success across model scales has broader implications. If attackers can induce behavioral changes with just 250 well-crafted documents, less than 0.0002% of total training data, then LLMs may be more vulnerable to poisoning than previously believed. The poisoned examples consisted of regular text with an embedded appended pseudo trigger followed by 400 to 900 random tokens teaching the model to emit gibberish upon seeing the phrase. So yeah, I'm sorry if I didn't explain that very clearly for people who are doing audio only, but they used like a caret, the word pseudo, in a closing tag to be the thing that would trigger this gibberish that was pulled out of the model after planting the documents. So that gibberish could have easily been a code snippet or something like that as well.
Yeah, we actually see it. And for anyone who's able to watch and see this and see kind of the example in here, it's like 85% gibberish. There's actually the sentence doesn't make sense, but it is legitimate languages and characters and stuff. But it is really just kind of gibberish text that's been thrown in there. But what this does is, as you mentioned, Chris, it really allows at least Anthropic, I should say, it allows them to say, hey, you know, is it, how feasible is this idea of sample poisoning? How easy, you know, is it possible? Does it matter? Does the size of the training data make a difference or anything? And Chris, as you mentioned, they just figured out, no, it's actually a small fixed amount, right? That is potentially all you need in order to create, or I should say, push an LLM to do something that it otherwise should not be able to do. The test that they did here was to insert a trigger word followed by gibberish text. And then the goal was, can we get it to generate more gibberish text? The goal, the big takeaway there being, if I can force it to generate gibberish, that means it's reading from gibberish. Therefore, I am, you know, obviously it's reading off of the poison set that we've given it. And with only 250 malicious documents being dropped in there, that's a very, very small range, which I think, Chris, as odd as this is going to sound, you could even use AI to generate. if you wanted to. So you could even have AI generate training data that ends up embedding some malicious code and then use AI to try and force it to give you something you shouldn't be able to do. But one of my biggest takeaways here is we're not kind of hypothetically talking about this. You know, I think data poisoning from an AI perspective or LLM poisoning is really something that folks have talked about in theory for a long time. Like, oh, well, technically, if you train something on the wrong data, it can give you what might be the wrong or malicious answer and response. And instead, we're seeing like, oh, yeah, it's very possible. And they actually made it work. There's an academic journal published that went with this, or I should say an academic paper, maybe the one with this too, by Anthropics Alignment Science, the UK AISI, and the Alan Turing Institute, as Chris mentioned earlier. But it's the largest poisoning investigation to date, and it proves it's actually not that hard to do. Now, the biggest takeaway is by far that poison attacks require a near constant number of documents, regardless of model and training size. The larger the model, the consistency, the vulnerability is. So that's one of my biggest takeaways here, Chris, is, you know, variety in model size doesn't, or parameter size, if you will, does not guarantee less, or I should say a smaller poisoning surface attack. In fact, it might be pretty consistent across the board. So without a doubt, you know, if you were to take that 250 static number and scale it up to 500 or 1,000 or something, you'd easily start to overweight and tip the scales in your favor, which is something that folks should be aware of. And also likely a way that adversaries are misusing LLMs to create malicious stuff for them.
Yeah. All right. So to test robustness, models were trained across 24 configurations, varying in size from 600 million to 13 billion data volume. And number of poison documents. So they did 100, 250, and 500. Each model was trained three times with different random seeds to ensure consistent results. The key insight is that training progress, i.e. the number of poison documents seen, predicts attack success more reliably than the total number of training tokens processed. Even though larger models saw much more clean data, they were backdoored just as easily, suggesting that defenders can't assume scaling up models makes them inherently more resistant to data poisoning. Results were evaluated by comparing the perplexity of model generations with and without the trigger. High perplexity indicated gibberish and confirmed successful backdoors. With 250 or more poison documents, all model sizes converged on successful attacks. At 100 documents, the results were unreliable. Figures from the study show attack dynamics across training progress and poison document count, consistently demonstrating that the behavior is tied to the exposure count, not data proportion. While this research focused on low-risk behaviors, the authors warned that similar techniques could be applied to more harmful backdoors, such as leaking sensitive data or bypassing safety filters. However, they argue that sharing these findings helps defenders more than attackers. Attackers still face challenges like gaining control of training data sources and creating robust poison content. The work underscores the need for scalable defenses that don't rely on proportional assumptions, especially as LLMs continue to grow and be deployed in high-stakes environments. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're going to say this every podcast from now till the end of this show, you know, when we go off the air, is that AI is a new security threat vector. And I was just reading somebody ranting today about how, you know, they're evaluating vendors and they have their SOC 2 and all these different sort of things that are supposed to signal they're secure. But when they ask them whether they're like, you know, logging prompts and keeping track of where the data in the LLMs is going and stuff, most organizations don't have any kind of consistent or, you know, reliable way to determine what's going on.
Yeah, agreed with you on that one. And it's going to continue to be the Wild West, unfortunately, until we start to get our arms around a better way to handle it. I think you and I have talked before just at some of the potential risks and dangers, but we'll continue to talk about it. And hopefully at one point in the show, maybe we'll look at some AI safety guidelines or things folks can do to kind of protect those implementations within their organizations. But yeah, unfortunately, it's going to continue to be something that I think is going to be a corporate or enterprise concern for a long time. And I hope it's not, but I think it will.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any slowing it down. Like, I know the EU and some different places are going to try and put some regulations around it, but it's just going to kill companies' ability to compete in the market because other people won't have guardrails around it or any limitations on how they're using it. So this, we're going headlong into this, and as defenders, it's just like try to keep up and figure out ways that we can detect when things are going sideways.
We'll do our best to keep up. But until then... Patch until you got everything patched up.
And with those wise words, sir, I will bid you farewell till next week, where you will be at a new location.
I will, and I'm happy to share that one with you when I get there.
All right, so take care,
it'd be
sir.
Great, Chris. Appreciate it. Take care.
Yeah. Bye. And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend, or subscribing and giving us a rating, or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake, with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.